and then more fully move over to equanimity in the context of loving kindness. So sleepiness is something that comes up a lot in practice. And it's said to come from a variety, there are a lot of possibilities about why one might get very sleepy or sluggish in practice, in meditation practice. So one possibility is really kind of coarse, you know, or concrete. It's 110 degrees outside. You're sitting in India. It's hot. You didn't get any sleep. Or you're very, very tired. Sometimes I think of it like, you know how we can sort of go and go and go, and then we finally go on vacation, and that's when we get a cold? It's like we go and go and go, and we finally sit down. It's like, whoa, I'm tired. That's, you know, an obvious set of reasons why sleepiness may come. Sometimes we get very sleepy in practice because it's a habitual pattern for us that when things get rough or difficult or challenging, it's like there's a signal inside our minds that says, must be time to go to sleep. Let's just zone and avoid this. That can be a common habit. Very commonly we get sleepy in practice because we're, for however long, we're in a phase where things are just kind of neutral. They're not very exciting and wondrous and opening and fantastic. They're also not very challenging and difficult. And we just basically get bored and we kind of go to sleep. Sometimes sleepiness arises strongly in practice because of that balance I've been talking about from the beginning, or alluding to since the beginning, of tranquility and calm on the one side and energy and alertness on the other. We're always working with both sides of that spectrum, but they're not always in perfect balance. Sometimes because of a particular phase of practice or a particular circumstance, or sometimes because of a personal tendency. So if the calm, concentrated, tranquil side of things is really deepening, but there's not enough just sheer energy in your system to match it, the first thing you go into, the first state, is classically known as sinking mind. I call it the ooze. And you just kind of start oozing along, and it's very placid. It's quite nice, but it's not very energized, and after a while you fall asleep. Sometimes, of course, we can have the opposite tendency. There's too much energy for the amount of tranquility, and while that feels really great for a little bit, if it goes on too long, it becomes agitation or restlessness, because there's just not enough sheer tranquility to match the energy. So we're not always consciously working with that, although sometimes we are. And we're just seeing where that lies. So if you have that tendency altogether, or just for a little while, or it just happens to be for a certain period of your practice that you're kind of getting calmer and more tranquil, and that's easy, but you don't feel a lot of energy, that's another reason why one might get quite sleepy in practice, and there are many more. So it's a very common experience. It can come from many different places. The first thing we want to do is a sort of opening of our attitude about it, rather than, you know the word papancha? You know, rather, papancha is a Pali word, and it means proliferation. As I heard one translator once describe it, he described it as the imperialistic tendency of mind, where something happens and the whole world is taken over. And the story I usually tell about it is this time I was teaching with Joseph somewhere, and Joseph and I were sitting in the kitchen having a cup of tea, and a man who'd been sitting came into the kitchen in some distress, And he said to Joseph, I had this really terrible experience. So Joseph said, well, what happened? And he said, I felt all of this tension in my jaw, and I realized what an incredibly uptight person I am and how I always have been and I always will be. And Joseph said, you mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw? And he said, yes, and I've never been able to get close to people and it's never going to change. And Joseph said, you mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw? And it was really interesting for me watching him go back and forth and back and forth. And finally, Joseph said something to him like, why are you adding a miserable self-image to a painful experience? It's like painful enough to feel all that tension in your jaw. But on top of that, we add, it's always going to be this way. This is what it means about me, and it's never going to change. We add so many things. And so one of the ways we describe meditation practice, certainly in terms of mindfulness practice, is we are looking for the add-ons and see if we can just release them. So then we can go back to our actual experience and see from there what might arise, what intuitions, understandings, responses, whatever it might be, but not from that whole clump of stuff that gets added on top, just through force of habit. So here we are, sleepy in our meditation. We look for the add-ons. I'm always going to fall asleep when I meditate. It'll never work. This stuff has worked for 2,500 years. It's hit a wall in me. I should never have taken all those drugs when I was young. I'll never be able to meditate because I don't have enough energy. I can't meditate until I do yoga for 15 years because then I'll have enough energy, or whatever it might be. There's a lot of stuff. I'm the worst meditator that ever lived, you know, all kinds of stuff. Rather than you feel tension in your jaw, like, oh, there's sleepiness, right? So we try to release those add-ons, come back to seeing, okay, this is the experience right now. So that's the first stage of mindfulness, which has that equanimity component. Let go of the add-ons. See what your experience actually is. And then with that relationship to our experience, we can take an interest in it. What does it feel like? What's it made of? It can be quite interesting to look at all these things which we usually just react to so quickly without taking much of a look. What does it feel like in your body? What's its nature? It's interesting to me sometimes to see how much aversion comes with sleepiness. Like, I don't want to, you know. All kinds of things. Okay, now here comes an interesting juncture. Maybe through the clarity and the force of the mindfulness, you see through the sleepiness, you see its changing nature. It doesn't get stronger, so that you feel you can either it dissipates or it stays the same, so you feel you can keep on practicing. Maybe that's not so. Maybe it does get stronger, or maybe it arose so powerfully that you actually need to apply some kind of antidote. And I find this a very interesting place, because sometimes people feel that's the abandoning of equanimity or mindfulness. But really it's not. You know, we can seek to apply an antidote or make a change in our energy or whatever it is from lots of different motivations. It can be from, I'm horrible and I'm going to sleep again in front of everybody, so therefore I'm the worst person that ever lived. Or it can be, I don't think there's enough energy here to really be aware, to be mindful. You know, I'm not balanced enough. Let me see if I can get into a better state of balance. No judgment, no condemnation, no hostility, no projection into the future. It's a very different place to be coming from, which I would encourage rather than the other. So maybe you're in that place. You say, you know what? I'm way out of balance. It's not working to just try to sit here with this experience. So there's actually a list somewhere in the Buddhist teaching, as you know, I'm sure. The teachings are often described as different lists. It was an oral tradition for about 300 or 400 years. Nothing was written down after the time of the Buddha for quite a while. And all of the teachings were memorized and passed from person to person through memorization. And to facilitate the memorization process, things were really made into lists, you know, the four of these and the eight of those and seven of those and 37 of those and 10 of those. And some people, just as a side note, feel dismayed when they think about the teachings not having been written down and feel they're somehow less authentic. I've heard anthropologists say that they feel oral traditions in many ways are more authentic because people invest in that process of preservation and memorization. And I have to admit, I think it's kind of true. It's like, if I want to learn something these days, I think, I'll Google it. And if I don't remember it, doesn't matter, because I'll Google it again. And I actually approach information very differently than I did when I was younger. So anyway, there are all these lists. So there's actually a list somewhere of ways to deal with sleepiness, which includes open your eyes, you know, let in some light, stand up if you're sitting, maybe choose to do walking meditation instead of sitting meditation. It's a very valid choice. It's a perfectly plausible kind of meditation. It's not inferior. And if you're just sluggish, you know, that might be the better choice. It might mean, we would say, I don't think this is on the list, but we would say try mental noting. Instead of just feeling the breath, actually say in, out, or rising, falling mentally, because that will add some energy. Also on the list is pull your earlobes. I never think of it when I'm sitting, but it's on the list. I'm sure the acupuncturists of the world can maybe tell us why, but I don't know why. Watch your aim. One of the things that happens in meditation practice is that our attention tends to get kind of diffuse. It's a little bit like what I was describing with myself. Instead of being with just this one breath, I was kind of with this breath and whatever might be coming next. Or I've seen a lot in my experience of doing walking meditation. Instead of being with just this step, it was, you know, like sometimes I'll be, say, at that wall, and I see that wall where I know I'm going to turn around in a few minutes, and I say, okay, I'll be mindful from there until I get to there. But actually, we can't do that. We can only be mindful one step at a time. So even though it seems like such a noble thought, it's almost like taking my energy body and hurling it to the other end of the room, which is different than just this one step, or just this one breath, just this one phrase, you know, with a kind of wholeheartedness of attention. So that's called aim. That's on the list. Or right aim, as, you know, the translation would be. Just aim your attention toward this moment. You don't have to worry about anything else. That will also pick up energy. You know, and the list goes on, and it turns out that the last thing on the list is take a nap. Which I always appreciated. I took note of the fact both that it was on the list and that it wasn't the first thing on the list. You know, so we, of course, would think, oh, I'm defeated, you know, I failed, I'm horrible, I have to take a nap. But no woes, you know, it's like, okay. So there's a suggestion of a certain lightheartedness or open-heartedness. It's like, okay, try this. See if that brings you to a different state of balance. Okay, maybe not. That's okay. Try that. It's not like, oh, God, you got to number 3 on the list. That's really bad, you know, like, you should have been able to conquer that at number 1. It's not like that. And so there's a very different spirit, and within that is a kind of balance that's implied. Okay, I'll try that. Try that. How about that? Let's do that. So it's another example of how mindfulness isn't necessarily promoting passivity or withdrawal or complacency. It's like, okay, I'm way out of balance. Let me try that. It's okay to do that. Okay? So equanimity in mindfulness practice is very much that ability to be with pleasant experience fully without grasping, unpleasant experience fully without getting all caught up in aversion, which is anger or fear, and neutral experience, which can tend to lead to just that kind of dullness or disconnection. So back to aversion, which I didn't do this morning. Clearly many things that come our way are unpleasant, from the mildly unpleasant to the grievously disappointing or painful or tragic. We go up and we go down, and we live in a very uncertain universe. The reflexive response to difficult or undesired or painful experience is aversion. It's and interestingly, as I'm sure you know, many of you, the Buddhist psychology does have this one concept that covers both anger and fear. They being considered two expressions of the same mind state, anger being the energized, outflowing, expressive form, fear being the frozen, imploding, held in form of striking out against what's happening, trying to declare it to be untrue. So anger is a very interesting mind state, as described in the Buddha's teaching. There's some very positive elements to it that are sometimes mentioned, the sheer energy, the motivating force to say no or to draw a boundary or to be clear about something. And there's some very destructive elements certainly that are described as well. And again, this is not at all about feeling a certain thing. It's about being lost in it, being in some way so in it that it becomes the basis for action, for example, or it defines our world, it defines our sense of possibility. So in the Buddhist psychology, anger is likened to a forest fire which burns up its own support. So we as the host can be devastated or even destroyed by the force of that anger. It can have a very clarifying effect, or anger can have a very deluding effect. It's like the example I used, you know, think of the last time you were really angry at yourself. How complete a picture of yourself do you think you were holding at the time? Or how narrow, how much were you involved in tunnel vision? Any of these forces, like grasping, aversion, and so on, tend to have that same contracting effect of tunnel vision. It's like that very famous saying in India where they say, if a pickpocket meets a saint, they see only the saint's pockets. You know, we can miss so much because we are just like fixated in a way through the narrowing scope of grasping or aversion. So there can be a kind of deluding quality to anger. I'm an idiot and I always will be. There's one. I can never change. I know exactly how this situation came about. all kinds of things that may not reflect actually the reality of, or the complex reality of a situation. And so we try to look at the state from all of anger or aversion from all angles. You know, the energy of it, which can be very positive, the deluding quality, which can be very negative, and many traditions would talk about trying to capture the energy without getting lost in that kind of narrowing, frozen tunnel vision, which can be so destructive and so limiting for us. And then the question, which is a very profound question, comes up of what is really strength? What is power? What's powerful in this situation? Is it getting engaged in a cycle of revenge and just going round and round and round and round and round and round and round? Is it in fact strong or powerful to have rigid categorizations? As we do loving kindness practice classically, as we'll begin, we go through many categories of beings that we offer loving kindness to: ourselves, someone known as a benefactor, someone who's helped us or inspired us, a friend, someone known as a neutral person, that is someone we don't strongly like or dislike, we just feel kind of neutral toward them, a person we find difficult, and ultimately all beings everywhere, all of life. That's like the trajectory of loving kindness. And it's interesting because people will, like I teach a 7-day intensive loving kindness retreat in February every year at IMS, and we go through all of those categories over the course of the 7 days, and we'll do a little bit of it here. We don't have 7 days, but we'll do, you know, some form of that trajectory. So, you know, sometimes people will choose a benefactor and they'll feel all this tremendous gratitude and regard and care for this person, and then they'll think, well, you know, there was that one time when I called them and they weren't really there for me. Maybe they're not my benefactor. Maybe they're my difficult person. And I once said to somebody, I had this fantasy of leading a loving kindness retreat where we just take one person, and the parts of them we really admire, they're like our benefactor, and the parts of them we feel at ease with, they're like our friend. The parts of them we don't know, they're like our neutral person. And the parts of them we don't like that much, they're like our difficult person. And the person I was talking to said, well, you know, we could just choose ourselves because we play all those different roles with ourselves. Like, life's complicated, actually. As the Dalai Lama often says, quoting Shantideva, friends become enemies, enemies become friends. You know, life's not that static and rigid always. And even within a relationship of enmity that doesn't seem like it's ever going to change, and it might not change, life is complicated. There's all kinds of different things that factor in. And so we want to open to that because that's what's real. You know, when we talk about working with aversive states and having equanimity or loving kindness for ourselves and for others, it's not about trying to be fanciful or make something up or disguise what we're really feeling and somehow supplant it with this make-believe kind of gooey stuff. Neither equanimity nor loving kindness means losing understanding and clarity and strength or strength of purpose or determination to act in certain ways. It doesn't really mean that, but it's easy to imagine it does. It's more a question of understanding that you know, if we're acting from a place of tunnel vision, then the action that we take will necessarily be limited. If we are deluded about options, then the action that we take will necessarily be limited. If we're just freaked out and we're kind of reflexively acting, then we're kind of at the mercy of that state and whatever it might bring to bear. And so we explore lots of different things. So this is not to say that anger or fear are bad or wrong or terrible, but we want to understand their nature and to understand ways that we might get lost, ways we might not, and to have equanimity, which really means spaciousness. It doesn't mean not caring, but it's a kind of spaciousness. When I said it's the balance that comes from wisdom, it's about perspective. So you might be on an airplane, and your airplane might sit on the runway for no reason that's discernible. Even once it lands in Seattle, you might sit on that runway and you think, couldn't they have planned this better? You know, what do you mean we have to sit on the runway and not go to the gate? And you might take it very personally, and it might be hurtful, and it might be upsetting, and then it escalates, and then you get into all this proliferation, and then you go wild. And you're having a really bad day because your airplane is sitting on the runway. Or you have some perspective. You know, this is going to make me sick if I rant and rave about this. Is anything going to happen differently because I'm freaked out about this? Is there something I can say that might actually be more effective than screaming at the flight attendant? Whatever it might be. You know, so it's not that you do nothing always, but you have a range of places that might motivate you and a range of options about the means you might employ to communicate your needs rather than being locked into that one mode. So it's kind of opening and freeing and exciting and creative to get into a realm of equanimity, because you just want to see clearly what's happening. So we talk about loving kindness really as that kind of play. It's a play of attention. And at the core, as I have said, is this sense of equanimity. It's what allows loving kindness to be loving kindness, which I'll go into more later or tomorrow. When I say loving kindness is a play of attention, it's very much connected to what I was just talking about. Like maybe we have a tendency, and we know it or we don't know it, to react in a certain way to certain kinds of situations, or to think of ourselves in a certain way, or to think of others in a certain way, like, oh, those people don't count, or I'm not going to talk to that person, I heard they were boring, or I don't like that kind of person or being, or whatever it might be. And the play of loving kindness is actually a willingness to look at ourselves and look at others from a different angle. So if, like in my favorite example these days, if you have the habit at the end of the day of looking back at yourself and your actions during the day as though to say, how'd I do today? And let's just say you have the habit of pretty well only remembering the mistakes you made. So much so that you think of that really stupid thing you said at lunch at the meeting, and your whole sense of who you are and all that you will ever be just collapses around that thing you said. the effort of loving kindness or the play of loving kindness is almost as though to ask yourself, anything else happened today? Like anything good within me? So it's effortful because we're not just kind of going along with the old habit, but it's a certain kind of effort that's not strained and phony and false. It's really like experimenting. It's stepping out of the rut that we're accustomed to and being willing to look at ourselves and others from different angles. So it's not as though you're insisting, oh, wasn't that a brilliant and witty thing I said at lunch? Maybe it was really stupid. And there are consequences to that. But that's not all that we are, ever. So it's that collapse, that tunnel vision, that fixation. That's what we're challenging through the loving kindness. So you think about the many beings we encounter who form the other for us. Not even through antipathy or prejudice, but just because we're indifferent. We look right through them. And so the practice of loving kindness is one of actually stopping. And instead of looking through them, looking at them. It might mean a conscious reflection. And there's several that are done kind of as part or prelude to the loving kindness practice. One is look for the good in someone. And here too, this, you know, this is very subtle. It doesn't mean an encouragement to try to pretend or deny what's difficult or conflicted or just wrong. But it means that if we fixate on what's difficult to the exclusion of any possibility of anything else, we will naturally feel more and more a sense of alienation and distance and kind of otherness. Whereas if we can find one good thing about someone, and this might include ourselves in a really bad day, where we need to make the effort, if we can find one good thing about someone and we reflect on it for a few moments, there's a certain sense of connection that happens from which vantage point we can honestly and directly look at what's wrong, but it's not with the same sense of this huge gulf of self and other. Now, this is an interesting experiment to make. So I first heard this reflection when I went to Burma in 1985 to do the first period of intensive structured loving kindness practice that I did. I'd always done it a little bit here and there, but never in that way and never with guidance. So I was in Burma and my metta teacher was Sayadaw Upandita. And he urged me toward that reflection one day, even with people I had some difficulty with. So I went back to my room and I thought of somebody that I really thought was quite obnoxious and difficult and irritating and annoying, and which I think was true. It was certainly true for me. But I think his behavior in general was pretty bad. And then I remembered witnessing him doing something quite beautiful, where we had a mutual acquaintance and I saw him do something for her that was just beautifully done. It was kind, it was generous, it was very, very well done, so she didn't feel condescended to or anything. It was just amazing. So I had that memory, and my first thought was, I don't want to think about that. That complicates things. It was easier for me, far easier for me, when he was in the all bad category. So that's one reflection that we do, and sometimes it's unreal. There is not going to be one good thing you find about somebody. It's just not real. And then there's another reflection that we do, which is also based on the teaching of the Buddhas, which is that all beings want to be happy. That basically we actually all want the same thing, and it's because of the force of ignorance that we suffer so much and create so much suffering for others. Or as the Dalai Lama would put it, if you're going to be self, this is the way before his English got better, this is the way he would say it, if you're going to be selfish, be a wise selfish. It's okay to want to be happy. That's actually good to want to be happy. Sometimes people feel very squeamish about that. Like even in doing the loving kindness where we use those words, people think, I don't know if I should want to be happy. That's like greed or grasping or something. But really, we should want to be happy. But first, we have to understand what happiness is. And we have to understand where it comes from. When we are happy, that is actually the wellspring of many good things. If we're demoralized, we're depressed, we're exhausted, it doesn't tend to be the time we can be the most generous, the most giving, the most open to others, because we're sort of in a state of collapse. It's when we have a certain sense of sufficiency. That doesn't mean pleasure, you know, or enjoying ourselves, but we have a connectedness, we have an openness, we have the sense of sufficiency. That's like inner abundance. And just as with material generosity, we need a certain kind of inner abundance in order to give. You know, no matter how much you have or don't have externally, by seemingly objective measures, there's an internal factor as well. I have been, and I'm sure many of you have been, either in this country or in other countries. I've certainly been in other cultures where there are people who have very, very, very little by any measure that we would use, but they're actually very generous. They both delight in giving, and they have some inner sense about giving. And sometimes, say in Burma, where that's very much the case, you know, I'd have that experience, and it was always very startling because every meal you have in the retreat centers there, or at least the ones I was at, every meal is like an offering from people. So in Burma, for example, on your birthday, you don't expect to get gifts, you expect to give gifts. So maybe it's your birthday, so you go off to the monastery and you offer food for everybody, and that's all celebrated. Things like that. And it'd be a very poor country. And yet every single meal would be an offering. And then sometimes I'd come back here and it would be like, whoa, isn't this interesting? You know, sometimes people with even a great deal didn't have that internal sense that they had enough at all. And so there just wasn't that feeling that they could give. So it's the same thing with loving kindness and our own happiness. Many times, for example, I've done the instructions for loving kindness for a benefactor, and afterwards someone would come to me and say, well, I chose the Dalai Lama as my benefactor, and things were going fine, and then I remembered, you know, what does he need me for? He's the Dalai Lama. And I find that a very interesting reflection. First of all, how do we know that? You know, for all we know, he's totally nourished every single day by the prayers and well-wishing and loving-kindness of others. And also, what an interesting thought. What I have to give couldn't count. It's too meager. It's too petty. It could never be enough. Like, why do we go there? It's an interesting place. All of which is to say that sense of sufficiency, of fulfillment, of open-heartedness is the source of a lot of resiliency and ability to give and share and serve and open. So our own happiness isn't just like having a good time, you know, with the right temperature in the room. You know, we don't care about anybody else who's suffering. It's not like that. It's a very different sense of things as we go along. So we're willing to experiment and to realize that really, maybe everybody does want to be happy. And so very rare is the understanding of where a greater happiness is to be found, or a more sustainable happiness is to be found, or I forget the name of my next book. It's either called True Happiness or Real Happiness or something like that. It's got a happiness title. I don't remember what it is, but whatever it is. We don't know where that's to be found either. And we can recognize that. You know, it doesn't mean that we don't care about the things people do, or we give everyone a pass, or we don't take action to try to make a difference. But we can know that really we share a lot. We share that urge toward happiness and a tremendous vulnerability that is life. It just is. You know, we think we're going along just fine and we're on a certain course and it's going to go from here to there, and we actually don't know how things are going to happen. You know, one phone call and we have a different life than we had this morning. It's just that way for everybody. And so we can do that reflection as well to realize how much we share, in fact. So those are the kinds of ways that we play with attention as we cultivate the qualities of loving kindness and compassion and so on.